On the evening of January 17, 2020, 24-year-old Scott Radican was murdered in his Arlington, Virginia apartment. His cause of death has not been released. However, the police have shared video footage of a person of interest. Our second case occurred in the afternoon of November 25, 2020, when 39-year-old Mary Johnson Davis disappeared while walking along Fire Trail Road on the Tulalip Reservation in Washington State. She was reported missing 2 weeks later by her estranged husband. And our final case took place in the early morning hours of July 18, 2021, when Destiny McLean, a 23-year-old, was shot and killed while standing at a food truck outside the Caramba nightclub in Phoenix, Arizona. The police do not have a description of the shooter, but thankfully, they do have information about the suspect's vehicle. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. As you guys probably know by this point, I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective, and each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. And if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever platform you use. Now this week, I will be switching things up a bit as you've probably noticed from the teaser. Instead of focusing on just one case, I'll be covering three. Now although these cases don't have enough information for their own episodes, they're still important and they still deserve our attention, which is why I've decided to talk about them today. And this isn't something I'm going to do all the time. I may do it two or three times a year where I give some attention and exposure to cases that I feel have some substance to them, have something where maybe just all we need is the right person to see or hear about this case. And who knows, maybe we get a break in it. So that's why I've decided to do it this way. But please, if you're listening on, you know, Apple Podcasts or Spotify and you want to leave a comment, please do. If you're watching on YouTube, leave a comment down below. Let me know what you think about this format, any questions, concerns, or recommendations, or maybe comments on how I can do it better. I'm all ears. Way down below, let me know what you think. We got a lot to cover tonight. I've had to study for three different investigations, so it was a fun week for me, but I do think we have some interesting stuff to talk about. So with that all out of the way, let's dive into these cases. Scott Wayne Radican was born on September 15, 1995, in Fairfax, Virginia, to his parents John and Linda. He grew up in Gainesville, Virginia, with his two sisters, where he was known for bringing joy to any situation, living life to the fullest, and having a great sense of humor. According to LinkedIn, Scott graduated from high school in 2014 and enrolled in Radford University, where he studied business administration and management. During his time there, he also served as vice president of the Sigma Chi fraternity. In 2019, a few years after graduating from Radford, Scott started his career as an account executive in Washington, D.C. He settled in the AVA Ballston Square high-rise apartment building on Randolph Street in Arlington. Tragically, it was in this apartment that Scott's life was taken on January 17, 2020. Unfortunately, the police have been tight-lipped about what happened to Scott, so there isn't much information available. But this is what we know so far. On January 17th at around 5:30 p.m., a relative of Scott's went to his apartment after not being able to get in touch with him. When they entered Scott's bedroom, they found him lying on the bed, unresponsive and covered in blood. The relative immediately called 911, and according to Fox 5, they mentioned to the dispatcher that there was a strong smell of bleach in the apartment and no apparent weapons could be seen. When first responders arrived, they pronounced Scott dead at the scene. The police were suspicious right away that a homicide had been committed. Not only was Scott's body covered in blood, but it also seemed like someone had tried to clean up the crime scene before leaving. Even though the police suspected that Scott had been murdered, they couldn't say for sure until an autopsy was completed. So when they talked to the media, they described his death as, quote, suspicious rather than a homicide. 4 days later, on January 21st, the Arlington County Police issued a brief statement announcing that Scott's death had officially been ruled a homicide. They stated he died as a result of, quote, trauma to the upper body. However, they did not disclose his specific cause of death. The police further mentioned that they had not identified a suspect or a motive, but assured the public that there was no immediate threat to the community. Now, regarding not releasing the specific cause of death, I understand why they did it, and I agree with them. There's really no advantage to telling the public how Scott was killed. There's just no advantage. And I don't think maybe the family wanted that out there, but ultimately it's an investigative tactic. We've talked about guilt knowledge before. They're acknowledging publicly that there's an upper body injury, but they want to keep the specific details about those injuries in house. And that's for the obvious reason. If someone comes along who's a witness or a potential suspect and they disclose details about Scott's death that would only be known to someone who's had some type of involvement with the actual homicide, they want to be able to use that to verify credibility. If they put everything out there, they lose that card that they can play later on. And again, I think just on from an ethical perspective, why do we really need to know exactly how he was killed? I don't see the advantage to it from a personal perspective, and I definitely don't see the advantage from an investigator's perspective. So although some of you may not agree with this, I personally am a fan of it at this point, especially this early on in the investigation. This case is not that old. Now, the next day, Scott's father spoke to Fox 5, expressing his grief over his son's death. He said, quote, "Somebody tragically killed him. We don't know who. We don't know why." For the following year, very few details were made public. However, behind the scenes, the police conducted an extensive investigation. This included gathering information, analyzing evidence from the crime scene, interviewing witnesses, and searching the area nearby where the crime occurred. In January of 2021, a year had passed since Scott was killed in his apartment. At that time, the police made the decision to release surveillance video and still shots from exterior security cameras showing a person of interest who was seen leaving the area around the time the crime occurred. The police described the person of interest as a white male, approximately 5'6" to 5'8" tall, weighing approximately 150 to 175 pounds. He was dressed in all black, carrying a black backpack, and was walking with his feet turned inward like someone with a pigeon-toed gait. The man had his hood up and was seen wearing black gloves and a dark face mask. The police asked the public for help in identifying the person in the footage. They believed someone out there had information that could help solve the case and bring justice for the Radican family. They urged anyone with the smallest piece of information to come forward and talk to detectives. That same month, Scott's father, John, spoke to Fox 5 about how the family continued to struggle with Scott's death. He said, quote, "We go through life, we see things, and we feel things. Things that remind us every single day of the loss. When I see other men with their sons, when I see families. We need to learn to live with that burden, but it would be of great help to resolve the who and the why for these events." John further said that the family was offering a $25,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction in the case. There was little to no information released about Scott's case until 2022, when 2 years had already passed. And at this time, the Radican family increased their reward to $50,000. They were hoping that this drastic increase would lead to someone finally coming forward. Despite these efforts, there have been no major developments in Scott's case since 2022. His murder remains unsolved, leaving his family desperate for closure. They urge everyone to view and share the surveillance footage of the person of interest. All right, let's dive into my perspective on this case. And these will be shorter because, again, we're not doing full episodes on them because there's less information, so less for me to weigh in on. But there were a couple things I wanted to point out. First off, this pigeon-toed gait. Strongly recommend that all of you go and watch the surveillance footage. There's some clips of it in here as well, but go over and watch it repeatedly a few times. See if there's anything you notice. for me, there's definitely something going on with his walk and his run, specifically his right leg. And it could be, as the police described it, pigeon-toed, but it all almost seems like it's more so with the right leg, which I want to pose a different theory to you guys. Yes, it could be a medical condition. It could be an injury that occurred during the assault. But I also want to put this out there. What if we don't know how Scott was killed. What if he was killed with a blunt force object, potentially a bat? Could this individual have slid that bat down in his pants as he was fleeing the scene? If he had been, this is the type of walk or the stance that they would have. So I just wanted to throw that out there as well, that potentially this person could be carrying the murder weapon, which is why their walk is off. As far as the crime itself, to me, this is definitely personal and premeditated. You have someone who's targeting Scott within this big apartment building and also bringing substances or using substances from the crime scene to try and destroy any forensic evidence. This is something that this individual went there with these intentions. That's probably why they were dressed the way they were, covering their face the entire way. And again, I feel like Scott was the target of this, and that's why police are coming out and saying there's no longer a danger to the community, because they're pretty confident that this individual went there with a specific intent, and that was to kill Scott. And one more thing about the surveillance video, because at this point I've watched it 100 times, I was looking at the suspect's clothing specifically, and there was a couple things that stood out to me. He had these white bottom sneakers. I've seen these before with like Nike Freeze. I know that because I have a pair of them. It could be a similar sneaker to that. And I also noticed that the backpack, it appeared to be maybe a Molly backpack. And initially in one of the angles, it looks like there's a big white logo on the back of the backpack that could be like North Face or Columbia or something like that. But then in a different angle where the sun is not reflecting off the bag, it actually looks like silver duct tape. So you can see that there, that maybe that white logo that I'm putting in quotations now, that I was seeing in the first video was actually the sun reflecting off the silver duct tape, which it would absolutely do. It's almost reflective. So I wonder why this person did this. Did they cover up something because they were going to commit a crime and maybe the bag had his name embroidered on it, something like that? But either way, I thought that the fact that there was duct tape on there was potentially an interesting element to this case. And all of these factors individually don't mean a lot, but in totality, with the way he was walking, the sneakers he was wearing, the clothing he was wearing, the backpack with the duct tape on it, all these things collectively may describe a person out there that somebody knows. Hey, listen, you know, from the video, I didn't know who it was, but then when you started to talk about the sneakers and then this black backpack with the duct tape, my buddy who lives in that area used to dress like that all the time. That's exactly what he wore, with the exception of the ski mask. And maybe that name gets brought up to law enforcement and they find out that this individual had a connection to Scott. That's how these cases go. It could be a pair of sneakers. It could be duct tape on a backpack. You never know. That's why we cover these cases. That's why we put them out there. Because again, it could be that smallest piece of information that cracks this case wide open. But that's the few observations that I had on this case. Again, it's relatively new, so I understand why police are keeping a lot of this close to the vest. At this point, they should be. You got video surveillance footage. They're probably still actively working this case behind closed doors to find out who Scott was connected to. Did he have any issues with anyone? And maybe there's somebody already on their radar. They just don't have enough to tie him to this case. But that's what we know from the outside. And I'm hoping that someone out there may be able to help push this case forward. So anyone with information related to Scott's murder is asked to contact the Arlington County Police Department's Homicide Robbery Unit at 703-228-4180. I also want to send my thoughts to Scott's family. I know that Scott's father has been the spokesperson, but there's a lot of people connected to this case and that have been victimized by this tragedy. And as Scott's father said, they need to know the who and they need to know the why. It's not going to bring Scott back, but at least they can start to process what actually occurred and maybe start to heal slightly so they can move on with their lives and not only live for themselves, but also live for Scott. All right, that's going to do it for our first case. And before we move on to the next one, let's hear from this week's sponsor, Babbel. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language with a second best way, and that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and rooted in real-life situations and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. In addition to learning the language, you also have Babbel's speech recognition technology, which helps you improve your pronunciation and your accent. And don't just take my word for it. Top universities like Yale and Michigan State University continue to prove that Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for just 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. And Babbel has over 16 million subscriptions sold. And if you need some security, Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are all backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. Listen, I'm a strong proponent of learning a second language. Where I live, the Spanish-speaking population is prevalent. And in a lot of situations, when I'm dealing with individuals, they don't speak English. And just being able to speak to them conversationally to accomplish whatever we're trying to accomplish is extremely advantageous and makes the situation go that much easier. I've told my kids numerous times as they're going through school, I would argue that knowing a second language is almost, if not more important than having a college degree. So if you guys want to check it out, here's a special limited time deal for my listeners and viewers. You can get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for my listeners and viewers at babbel.com/detective. Once again, get 55% off at babbel.com/detective. That's spelled babbel.com/detective. Rules and restrictions may apply. Listen, Babbel's been with me for a long time on multiple channels. If you want to support me, make sure you support them. Okay, we're back. So let's talk about the disappearance of Mary Johnson Davis, who was born on August 31st, 1981. Mary, a member of the Tulalip tribes, has been described as, quote, spunky and lovable, and she's the type of person that can make you laugh even when you're sad. Now, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of publicly available details on Mary's adult life. What we do know that is in the summer of 2020, Mary and her husband were living with Mary's sister, Jerry. Then one day in the fall of 2020, Mary and her husband unexpectedly left Jerry's and moved 40 miles away to Marysville, Washington, located right next to the Tulalip Reservation. CNN reported that by November of 2020, Mary and her husband's relationship was severely strained. Mary started staying with friends and only went back to the house that she shared with her husband to pick up mail and to take a shower. Although Mary was going through a lot, she stayed in contact with her sister, Jerry. They spoke on November 24th, but after that, Jerry stopped hearing from her sister. On December 9th, Mary's husband contacted Jerry and revealed that he hadn't seen Mary for a few weeks. Because of this, he had reported her missing to the Tulalip police earlier that day. According to the Herald Net, when reporting Mary missing, her husband provided the police with a pre-typed statement describing how he usually talked to Mary every 2 days, however, he hadn't seen or heard from her in a few weeks. He said he found it strange that she hadn't come by to pick up her mail, which included her monthly check. He explained that in the past, she always picked up her check the same day it arrived. All right, so let's address the elephant in the room, this pre-typed statement. I've been doing investigations for almost 20 years as a police officer and as a detective. I've never had someone come into the station to report someone missing with a typed out document to kind of explain what had occurred. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean it's not possible. I don't know what type of person Mary's husband was. Maybe he did better explaining things in writing than he did verbally. Maybe because of the circumstances surrounding their relationship prior to her going missing, he felt like the best thing he could do was type it all out, make sure he got it right. Because as we have seen in the past, in his defense, there are situations where someone who's legitimately trying to help but is nervous, goes in there, starts talking, and actually gets themselves in trouble with law enforcement because they say something and then they have to correct themselves. And it could be completely innocent, but now they find themselves in a situation where they're just trying to help, but now they're a person of interest, or even worse, they're a suspect. So although this isn't something we normally see, and it is odd, I don't want to automatically say that it's incriminating in nature, again, without knowing who he is as a person. But I will say the one positive thing about this is by him writing everything down, it does lock him into a statement pretty concretely. So if down the road they're able to discredit something he said through other evidence, it actually could come back to hurt him. Now, after receiving this report, the Tulalip Tribal Police began investigating Mary's disappearance. Through interviews and cell phone records, they learned that on November 24th, Mary's husband dropped her off at a friend's house with a suitcase. This friend, who we're going to call Steve, lived on Fire Trail Road, which is on the northern border of the Tulalip Reservation. After she was dropped off, Mary confided in Steve that she was afraid her husband was going to move to California and take all of her stuff with him. Hoping to get Mary some legal advice, Steve immediately took her to the Tulalip Tribal Court, but there were no attorneys available. Mary and Steve went back to Steve's place, where Mary planned on staying the night. They also had plans for the next day, November 25th. Mary told Steve that she wanted to visit a couple she knew in Oso, which is around 30 miles away from the reservation. Steve agreed to drop Mary off at a nearby church on Fire Trail Road, where she would meet another friend who would take her to Oso. To make things even more complicated, a man staying with Steve, who we're going to call Brad, also hoped to catch a ride with Steve on the 25th. According to the Herald Net, at around 1:30 p.m. on November 25th, Mary and Brad were waiting in Steve's truck for a ride while he finished getting ready inside the house. Steve felt like Mary and Brad were being impatient, which made him upset, so he decided not to give them a ride after all. Mary and Brad then got out of the truck and began walking east on Fire Trail Road. Since Steve didn't give Mary a ride to the church, she ended up being late to meet the guy who was going to give her a ride to Oso, and we're going to call him Adam. When Mary didn't show up to the church on time, Adam left and drove west on Fire Trail Road. While he was driving, he spotted Mary and Brad walking, but he didn't stop to pick them up. Instead, he texted Mary, telling her his truck was too full to fit Mary and Brad, so he'd have to meet her back at the church later. Not long after, at approximately 1:52 p.m., Mary texted Adam saying, quote, "I am almost to the church." However, Mary never arrived at the church, and Adam never heard from her again. Mary also didn't make it to the couple's house she wanted to see in Oso, but according to CNN, she did leave a voicemail begging them to come pick her up. Then, at 2:30 p.m., Mary made a call to a different person, but the woman who answered said she was too busy to talk. This was the last time anyone actually heard from Mary. An hour later, at around 3:30 p.m., cell phone records indicated that Mary did in fact make it to the Oso area. However, the police knew that she couldn't have walked there in an hour, since it was a 25-mile walk from the reservation. This led the police to theorize that someone picked Mary up and drove her to Oso. But if that was true, then why didn't she ever go to the couple's house? The police kept digging and learned that after 3:30 p.m., Mary's phone went offline. It stayed that way until around 8:50 p.m. when it connected to a tower in the greater Marysville, Tulalip area. Her phone remained there until the next morning when it was powered off. Since then, it hasn't been powered back on. As detectives pieced together Mary's whereabouts on November 25th, they tried to find surveillance footage from places she might have been based on cell phone data. Unfortunately, they couldn't find any because too much time had passed between when Mary was last seen and when she was reported missing. The Herald Net reported that in addition to reviewing cell phone data and surveillance cameras, the police also interviewed multiple people, including Adam and Brad. Both men claimed to know nothing about what happened to Mary. Adam said that he hadn't heard from Mary since she texted him, "I'm almost at the church," and Brad told the police that during their walk on Fire Trail Road, he stopped at a friend's house while Mary continued walking to the church, and he hadn't seen or heard from her since. The police also wanted to speak to Mary's estranged husband, but he has not consented to an interview. And according to Mary's family, after reporting Mary missing, he hired an attorney, changed his number, and moved to California. Now, based on all the evidence police had collected so far, they weren't exactly sure what happened to Mary. They felt like all possibilities were still on the table, so the police, along with Mary's family, continued searching for her, but there was no sign anywhere. By November of 2021, a whole year had passed since Mary disappeared, and the police were no closer to figuring out what happened to her. However, they still had a list of people they were investigating and a new $60,000 reward, with $50,000 coming from the Tulalip tribes and $10,000 coming from the FBI. Around that same time, Mary's family spoke to CBS News about Mary's disappearance. They said, quote, "It's like she just vanished. You think you would be able to get some leads, but after a year, it's just frustrating and heartbreaking." Unfortunately, there haven't been any major investigative updates in Mary's case since 2021. She is still missing, and her family is still desperate for answers. They ask that everyone share Mary's missing person poster. Okay, so now for my perspective on the Mary Johnson Davis case. And I'm going to break this down into two parts because I just think it's going to be easier to track that way. So first off, let's talk about the chain of events in chronological order, the best we can, knowing what here can be confirmed as fact, or at least we assume has been confirmed as fact. So first off, obviously, the text message, 1:52 p.m., allegedly, she writes, almost to church. Now that's, I'm assuming, according to Adam or through cell phone records. But I do have a couple questions about that. We'll get back to it. The second thing we have is we know that she makes a call to the couple in Oso to come pick her up. They don't do that. And then we have another phone call at 2:30 p.m. where she calls some unknown woman. The woman is not free to talk. I don't know the specifics about it. Again, this case isn't that old, so not everything has been released. But I'm assuming during that call, there wasn't anything that stood out to this woman where she felt like Mary was in danger. Or I think she would have remembered that. Maybe she wouldn't have rushed her off the phone. It might have been something as simple as, you know, what are you up to? Hey, you know, maybe Mary's gearing up to ask her for a ride, but before she even can, this woman's like, hey, Mary, I can't talk right now. And obviously gets off the phone. And then we have the cell phone tracking. We know that her phone was pinged tracked to a tower near Oso at 3:30 p.m. And then the device was off from 3:30 to 8:50 p.m. But before we get to that, let's talk about the 3:30 p.m. time where the phone is pinged in Oso, because I think that's important. Looking it up on the map, I can see that Marysville is about 35 to 40 minutes away from Oso if you're driving. So taking that into consideration, that would mean that Mary had to leave Marysville around 2:45 to 2:50 p.m., which is only about 15 to 20 minutes after she makes that last phone call. So a very small window there. And what does that tell you? Whatever happened, happened right after that. Whoever picked her up or whoever encountered her was almost immediately after that phone call. And I do think that phone call could suggest that at that point, Mary had not found a ride yet. And she was starting to get more desperate to find someone who was willing to drive her all the way to Oso, which was not that close. So let's go back to the 3:30 p.m. to 8:50 p.m. Yes, the phone's off. It goes back on at 8:50 where it pings off a tower in Marysville at approximately 8:50 p.m. It's there all night. And then in the morning, while still in Marysville, it goes off and is never turned back on again. You could look at this two ways. For me, it's more likely that whoever is responsible for what happened to Mary was probably in possession of the phone at that time and disposed of the phone, turned it off, broke it, whatever they did, and that's why it was never turned on again or never located. It could also mean, and we'll get more into this scenario in the second part of this perspective, it could also mean that maybe Mary didn't want that phone to be tracked anymore, but we'll get into that. So that's really where we are at this one. We know that Mary was in possession of the phone at 2:30 p.m., and we know that the phone pinged off a tower in Oso at 3:30 p.m., so as I said earlier, if she's not in possession of the phone when it reaches Oso, that means whoever she encountered or whatever happened to her or her phone happened between 2:30 p.m. and approximately 2:45, 2:50 p.m. Not a large window. But I think that leads us into the second part of this perspective, because we've talked about the timeline in chronological order, what we know, or at least what police have told us. But now we have to talk about the who, because there are a couple players in this game, in this mystery. And there's a few scenarios that could play out based on who you think could potentially be involved. Let's start with the husband. There are some questionable things about the husband. Obviously, the pre-typed statement, the hiring of an attorney, the moving to California immediately, not being cooperative with police. You could look at it and say this is incriminating. I think it's easy to make an argument that their relationship was already strained. This individual obviously knew he would be at the top of the list as far as potential suspects and didn't want to say anything that could potentially have him in jail for something he didn't do. So at the advisement of his attorney, he has just stayed quiet. And we don't know how cooperative he has been. Maybe there have been conversations behind closed doors that law enforcement just hasn't relayed to us. But I think with the husband, he dropped her off with the friend. I don't know, based on what we know about this case, if he even knew that she was trying to get to Oso. He dropped her off at the friend's house. Did he know that's what her intent was, or was he just dropping her off without any knowledge of where she was planning on going next? I don't know. But based on what we know, I think it's hard to deduce this down to, oh, the husband did it. Some cases it seems more obvious. This is not one of them. So let's turn our attention to Steve. The story about Steve is a little perplexing to me because everyone is different, but his alibi, if you will, is, listen, Brad and Mary were in the car. They were being impatient. They upset me. I kicked them out and told them to find their own ride. As adults, I've never really experienced that. We all get agitated with friends, and especially if you're doing them a favor and they're ungrateful, but to just say, hey, you're walking on your own, I don't know, Steve. So I guess that could be in his nature, and that's something he might do. But on the surface, it seemed a little odd. But regardless of what you think about Steve, we know that there is some truth to what he's saying, because according to him, Brad and Mary exited the vehicle and started walking up the road. And we know that there's truth to that, because Adam, who's not connected to Steve, will later tell law enforcement that, yeah, Mary was supposed to meet him. And while he was driving down the road, he saw Mary and Brad walking. So it confirms that there is some truth to what Steve had actually said. But let's talk about Brad quick, and then we can move on to Adam. Brad says that while they're walking, he stops at a friend's house, and Mary continues on the way. I don't know about that. I don't know if that's true or not. It seems like if Brad was looking for a ride and his friend were that close, why wouldn't he just walk there? But either way, if I'm law enforcement in this, I'm obviously vetting what Brad had to say. I'm talking to his friend to confirm the story. But then I'm also looking into the friend as well, because you could have a situation where maybe Mary doesn't continue to walk. Maybe she stops with Brad at the friend's house and something goes wrong there at approximately 2:30, 2:40 p.m. And those individuals would know about Mary's destination that she was trying to get to as far as Oso. And I'm going to come back to that, so just bear with me. Last person I want to talk about is Adam. As I just mentioned a few minutes earlier, he's driving down the road, sees Mary with another man. I don't know if he knew who Brad was, but clearly it upset him. He continued driving, didn't pick either of them up. Sounds to me like maybe Adam had other intentions. Maybe there were some feelings there. Because it would be a really good friend to drive you 30 miles to a new destination, and maybe he was offended by the fact that it appeared, at least by driving by, that Mary was bringing a male counterpart with her for the ride, which Adam wasn't expecting. Adam's a little interesting because we know that Mary had texted him at 1:52. It doesn't appear from what we know he responded. He said that she never showed up at the church. How do we confirm that? We would have to look at his cell phone coordinates to see where he was throughout that day. That goes for everybody, by the way. That goes for the ex-husband. That goes for Brad. That goes for his friend. You have to confirm that their locations are in line with what they're saying, and you do that through their cell phone coordinates if possible. But back to what I was saying a few minutes ago to kind of wrap this all up as far as the phone, and I said I was going to come back to this. What's interesting about the phone is you have to assume that whatever happened to Mary in Marysville, it was one of two situations. One, she was with someone, something went down, and whatever happened to her, the person who's responsible knew what her destination was. And that's why they would take the phone there, have it sit there for a couple hours, and then drive back home to try and serve as a decoy, a diversion for law enforcement. The other angle, if you were to go that route, is to say this is just a random person that picked her up and they're not known to us yet. And they drove her to Oso. And once she got there, something happened, which didn't allow her to reach the couple's home. But it would seem odd to me that this individual, if they had nefarious intentions, they would drive all the way to the location where their victim wanted to go. And then once arriving, they would do something to her. It's not impossible, but in my opinion, highly unlikely. And then finally, the one last scenario that I want to talk about, which is an absolute long shot, but I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't mention it. What if Mary didn't want to be found? What if, based on what was transpiring around her, without us knowing all the details, she was looking for an opportunity to disappear? Now, I'm going to go back before you guys are start yelling at me through the television screen or through your phone or you're listening on audio. I don't believe this happened. Based on her behavior leading up to this incident, if that were the case, she wouldn't be calling everyone and their brother for a ride. But I'm just throwing it out there as a possibility because every scenario I've talked about so far, let's just call it what it is, would be a situation where Mary is either being held captive somewhere or she's deceased. Not the best outcomes. There's still a possibility that she's out there somewhere, and I hope for Mary's sake and her family's sake that that is the case. I say all that to say this. In comparison to some of the other cases we cover on Detective Perspective, this is relatively new. And so law enforcement is still looking for information that may help solve this case. And maybe someone watching or listening tonight has that piece of information that could catapult this case forward and get it reinvigorated and lead to some answers for not only law enforcement, but more importantly, the family. So just to recap real quick on this one so you have all the details. Mary Johnson Davis was last seen on November 25th, 2020, walking along Fire Trail Road on the Tulalip Reservation in Washington State. She was reported missing 2 weeks later by her estranged husband. When Mary went missing, she was 39 years old, 5'6", 115 pounds, with black or dark brown hair and brown eyes. She has a sunburst-style tattoo on her upper right arm, a scar across her nose, and a birthmark on the back of her neck. She may be also wearing glasses. So if you have any information, please call the Tulalip Trial Police Department at their tip line, which is 360-716-5918. I want to send my thoughts out to Mary's family as well. If they happen to see or hear this episode, we're thinking of you. Don't lose hope. Hopefully we can find the answers that you're seeking. And worst case scenario, we can identify the individual or individuals responsible and bring them to justice. Okay, to end this episode, I want to tell you about Destiny McLean, who was born on November 28, 1997 in Phoenix, Arizona. She grew up very close to her mom, Brenda, and her three sisters. They admired Destiny for how humble and kind-hearted she was. She always had something nice to say about everyone. Destiny's family always loved her creativity. She could do anything, sewing, makeup, hairstyling, design, you name it, she could do it. After graduating with honors from high school, Destiny wasn't sure about her future career. She had many talents and interests, which made choosing a path difficult. While considering her options, Destiny took a job at Amazon and continued living at home with her mom and sisters. They were all best friends and spent a lot of time together when they weren't at work. On the night of July 17th, 2021, Destiny, who was now 23 years old, went out for the second time in a year. Due to being a homebody and the COVID-19 pandemic, she hadn't been going out much. However, that night, she had plans to meet up with a coworker who was going through a divorce. Destiny took an Uber and joined several friends in Phoenix. Their evening ended up at the Caramba nightclub located at 1724 East McDowell Road. According to Fox 10, at around 3 a.m. on what is now July 18th, Destiny and her friends left the nightclub. As they were heading to one of their cars, they noticed a food truck in the parking lot and decided to get in line to buy some food. At 3:23 a.m., while waiting in line, shots were fired into the food truck line, and Destiny was tragically hit in the chest. Despite efforts from bystanders, she couldn't be saved. After 911 was called, emergency responders took Destiny to a nearby hospital where she was pronounced dead. Detectives arrived at the scene and interviewed any witness they could find. Multiple people reported seeing a dark-colored vehicle leaving the area heading eastbound on McDowell Road from 17th Street right after the shots were fired. However, there was no clear description of the driver or the vehicle. They knew it was dark-colored, but nothing more than that. Based on all the witness statements, detectives now believed that unknown suspects fired shots from the dark-colored vehicle into the crowd. However, they did not believe that Destiny was the target of the shooting. Over a week later, on July 27th, the police held a press conference where they showed surveillance footage of the car they believed was involved in Destiny's murder. They couldn't identify the exact make or model, but described it as a newer, dark-colored sedan with four doors. They asked the public to contact them if they recognized the vehicle. They also asked anyone who was in the area that night to get in touch, as they might have seen something important. Destiny's mother, Brenda, also spoke at the conference. She said that every day the family woke up to not knowing why Destiny was killed. She pleaded with anyone who had information to come forward, stating, quote, "Destiny didn't deserve this." On August 8th, Destiny's family organized a fundraiser to collect money for a reward and bring awareness to the shooting. They managed to raise $4,000, which went directly toward the reward. There were few developments in Destiny's case until February of 2023. During that month, Brenda shared with 12 News that the family wants Destiny to be remembered for who she was and the positive impact she made on others, rather than just her death. Destiny was a vibrant, caring, and loving person who brought joy to everyone she encountered. She had a passion for helping people and bringing smiles to their faces. She was more than just a murder statistic. In order to make sure that Destiny's memory lives on and her giving nature continues to inspire others, Brenda established the Our Destiny, Our Future Foundation. Helping others has been a healing process for Brenda, allowing her to focus on preserving Destiny's legacy even as her murder remains unsolved. When speaking with 12 News in February of 2023, Brenda also provided an update on the case, mentioning, quote, "To my knowledge, the case is not cold. I do know that they have been working, but at this point, there's nothing they can release to me." While Brenda hopes for answers in Destiny's case, she remains committed to helping others and honoring her daughter's memory. She believes Destiny would be proud of her, and I have to agree. Unfortunately, there have been no further updates in Destiny's case, and her family continues to seek answers. They ask that everyone review and share the photos of the car involved in Destiny's murder. Okay, so now from my perspective on this investigation, and as you can probably imagine, this will not be a long one. The main reason I'm covering this case is as for a call to action. That's why I wanted to do an episode like this, where there wasn't a lot of meat on the bone, but as I said at the top of the show, all of these cases deserve the attention. So for this one, as far as my perspective, I don't think this is going to be some crazy theory of mine. I think probably most of you have came to this conclusion already. This was a targeted shooting, and I don't believe Destiny was the target. You could be looking at a situation where it was gang-related, drug-related, or it could have been retaliatory towards the Carrabba nightclub. I don't know the specifics about the Carrabba nightclub. I don't know what they were involved in. In my own personal experience and professional experience, sometimes there's an underbelly of these nightclubs. It could be drugs, it could be prostitution, it could be some type of gang affiliation with that club. There could be a lot of reasons that this area was targeted. I would also want to know about everybody who was outside in line or in the area with Destiny at that time. Was there anybody there who had a gang connection or a drug connection who could have actually been the target of the shooting and they just haven't been identified publicly by law enforcement yet? I ask this because if you are able to identify the victim, you could reverse engineer it and potentially identify the suspect. I will say the only thing that I find perplexing, and this is without knowing how many people were in line, how many people were in that area at the time of the shooting, where was Destiny standing in that line, how many people were in front of her, how many people were behind her. It is interesting that only she was struck by a bullet. Is it possible? Of course. I've seen it numerous times where everybody but the intended target is hit. It's amazing how this stuff happens sometimes. I would love to know how many rounds were actually fired. It doesn't sound like there was a lot. If you were to tell me that there were 15 shots fired and they were all in her direction and only she was hit, I may take a pause and reconsider the idea that she wasn't the target. But based on what we know, it seems to me like she was hit with a stray bullet, and unfortunately it struck her in the wrong place where she couldn't survive her injuries. But at this point, you know what I know, and you've seen the photos just like I have. If I were to speculate, and I always hate doing this because I don't want to narrow your field of view, but to me, just based on my limited experience with vehicles, it looks like a sedan, possibly a Chevy Malibu. If you really look at that video, because there's obviously stills and a video, it looks like for a second, and it could just be the lighting around it, that the emblem on the front of that vehicle is gold. And anybody who knows Chevy vehicles, the emblem on the front is a gold emblem. And I will say, in my anecdotal experience, a lot of times you do have gang members or drug dealers, for some reason, they really did like the Chevy Malibus. I don't know why, but I've seen a lot of individuals who are in that world driving Chevy Malibus for one reason or another. I don't know. They're decent looking cars, but they're relatively cheap. Take that with a grain of salt. But just my look at it, from my perception, it looks like it could be potentially a dark colored Chevy. But at the end of the day, this isn't about my perspective. It's about your perspective and maybe one of you out there knowing something that could help solve this case. So just to recap, in the early morning hours of July 18th, 2021, Destiny McLean was shot and killed while standing at a food truck outside of Caramba Nightclub, located at 1724 East McDowell Road in Phoenix, Arizona. Police are searching for a newer model dark-colored four-door sedan, which was last seen traveling eastbound on McDowell Road from 17th Street. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Phoenix Police Department at 602-262-6151 or silent witness at 480-WITNESS or 480-948-6377. Finally, I want to send my thoughts to Brenda and her three daughters. Obviously, this is a huge loss, and I'm inspired by your willingness to take this horrific situation and turn it into a positive that could potentially help others. I don't know if I could do what you're doing, Brenda, but again, my thoughts are with you and your family, and I think all of us should take a page out of your book and what you're able to do, because clearly you're a better person than me. And that's going to do it for this week's case, guys. Just to recap, we covered Scott Radigan, Mary Johnson Davis, and Destiny McLean. Let me know what you think about this episode. Like I said, this is more of a call to action episode where they're newer cases, not a lot is known about them, but we're in that window where you guys can really make a difference. If you like this style of episode, I will make sure to incorporate it throughout the year. Like I said, 3 or 4 times a year at max. I like doing the cases that I can get more in depth on, but still, weigh down with your comments below. Let me know what you think. And as always, like the video. If you're watching on YouTube, it helps get this in the algorithm so more people can see it. But that's going to do it for me, guys. Everyone stay safe out there, and I will see you next week.